Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Mike Rams. I'm lucky enough to be the master here at Darwin College. And it's very, very nice to be able to welcome you all to the very first of our Darwin College Erasmus seminars. This series is being launched this term. We hope it will become a major event in the Darwin calendar. And we believe that it fills a gap between what you will all be familiar with, of course, our Darwin College lecture series, with a bit of a plug here, isolation coming up. January the 20th will be the first one and promises to be another cracking series of Darwin College lectures. But those are for a public audience. This seminar series is to fill a gap between that and our much more informal, intimate research seminars that we have, which is largely for students and postdocs to try out and test their ideas on the community. And so there was a considerable feeling amongst our Darwin Fellowship that actually it would be really good to fill that gap with a seminar series that demonstrated and draws upon our intellectual capacity within and strengths, our interdisciplinarity and our international outlook in order to explore some of the global challenges that face society and especially the academic community. And therefore, I can think of no one better to give our first inaugural lecture, Professor Catherine Balnard. So, as I'm sure you all know, she's the professor of EU law and employment law here at the University of Cambridge. She's a fellow of Darwin, she's a fellow of Trinity College, and deputy director of UK in a Changing Europe. She was, as many of you will probably have heard, a wonderful voice of reason and clarity on both radio and television and elsewhere during the Brexit political turmoil. My goodness, more turmoil. And we're very fortunate to have her to contribute today, but also some of you will have heard she gave a very wonderful contribution to the symposium that was held in memory of one of my distinguished predecessors as Master of College, the late Willie Brown. So this evening, Catherine will speak on what happens when enforcement doesn't happen, Brexit, free movement and Great Yarmouth. Afterwards, Dr. Nigel Bowles, our senior member of Darwin and a key organiser of this seminar series, will run, lead the Q&A. And so we'll hand over to him afterwards. The lecture is being recorded. The Q&A will not be. Please do turn off phones. But now, please join me in welcoming Catherine to give.
Well, thank you very much indeed for those immensely kind words. It's a great honour and privilege to be here this evening. It's perhaps apposite to be talking on the rights of EU migrant workers for the first Erasmus lecture and to talk about enforcement of employment rights in the college of your wonderful former master, Willie Brown, to whom I owe a great deal. And so I'm going to talk to you a bit this evening about some of the work that I've been doing with my colleague, Fiona Costello, who's sitting over there, about looking at the experiences of migrant workers, EU migrant workers, who came to the UK, and we are focusing our work on Great Yarmouth. Now, I want to tell you a story about Great Yarmouth. Great Yarmouth is probably a place that some of you may have never heard of, let alone visited. And just so you know where it is, it's there. It's there where the red arrow is. For those of you who are not British, London's at the bottom, Cambridge sort of in the middle, and we are looking at right at the far east tip of East England. For those of you who've not been there, it is a declining seaside resort. It once had a thriving tourism industry, and for those of you who were British, you might have been on the beautiful sandy beaches and tried to swim in the bitterly cold North Sea. It was at its prime in the late 19th century. Dickens wrote part of David Copperfield there, and there are some very fine Victorian Edwardian villas, which once hosted theatres, concert halls, but are now sadly the homes for slot machines or closed down altogether. And there's some very good crazy golf. Now, this is a town of significant decline, a town which has been declining since the 1950s and perhaps earlier, a decline exacerbated by the arrival of cheap air travel and package tours in the 1970s to the warm sun of the south of Spain, Italy, and elsewhere. So why am I telling you this story? This is a story of EU migrant workers. This is a story of their lives living in once grand Edwardian and Victorian villas, which have been bought up and turned into HMOs, homes of multiple occupation. These are now lived in primarily by EU nationals who came to Great Yarmouth to work in the three P's sector: picking, packing, and plucking. In other words, they worked in local chicken factories and in local farms. They took advantage of their rights as EU migrant workers under Article 45 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union and under the Citizens' Rights Directive. And these migrant workers came to Great Yarmouth in waves, broadly coinciding with the accession dates of their countries to the EU. So first came EU migrants from Portugal, including, crucially, a large diaspora of Portuguese population from Africa and Asia. And then the second wave were those who came from Central Eastern European countries, particularly Poland, Lithuania and Latvia. And finally, the so-called A2 wave, those coming from particularly Romania and to a lesser extent Bulgaria. And there is a significant Romanian Roma population in the town. Now, why did they come? As I said, they came for work. And they came for work in Bernard Matthews. For those of you who are British, you will remember the advert about Bootiful and turkey plucking. It's no longer actually owned by Bernard Matthews. It's owned by a company called Two Sisters. But if they're not working in poultry factories, they're working in and around the local farms. This is a farm very near Blakeney, which we were just discussing, Sharrington's, and this is a very cheerful Bulgarian picking absolutely delicious Sharrington strawberries. What we know about this work is labour intensive and low paid, involving long antisocial shifts. Workers are often agency workers, and many are on so-called zero-hour contracts, which mean they only work when there is work available for them. They're not guaranteed minimum amounts of work. Local population doesn't want to do this work. Local population thinks it's undesirable work, and thus the people who are doing the work are also undesirable, given, in their view, their lower educational backgrounds and attainment. So what we want to do is to understand the experience of the people who were there. What was life like for them as an EU migrant worker, both before Brexit and after Brexit? And we've been working with a charity called Gyros. Now, Gyros is a migrant support charity, and it holds drop-ins in what was the Debenham store before Debenham shut down. And it gives advice to EU migrant workers in their own language. They have Portuguese speakers, Polish speakers, and so forth. And Gyros have been really helpful to us because they've let us have access to all of their data they've collected from 2015 to 2021. And they've also facilitated access for us to meet some of their clients in focus groups. Now, just to give you a sense of Gyros's clients, you can see the predominant nationalities at the bottom, which is essentially Romanian and also Portuguese, which is the largest group. The dominant group that access advice are women. The average age is 47. It's worth bearing in mind we're not talking young migrant workers, which is the stereotype. And they all have, they rate their English skills as usually limited or very limited, and they also have very poor IT skills. And that's significant because the EU settled status scheme, to which they all had to apply, all had to be done online. And that, of course, raises serious problems for them. We also undertook ethnographic research living in one of the HMOs in Great Yarmouth. When I say we, in fact, it was because I'm a very senior professor. I didn't do it myself. I asked Fiona, who did the hard work, and she lived in the HMO in Great Yarmouth and lived and recorded the their experiences. That is the house that she lived in. It doesn't look bad from the outside until you go inside and you discover just how really rather grim it is. And that was the stairs going up to the back. There's no heating in the house, no proper electricity in the room that Fiona was living in. It was not good. Now, the HMO that I've just been talking about is on St. Peter's Road. That's St. Peter's Road. It's the most depressed street in Great Yarmouth and the poorest ward in Great Yarmouth. There are a large number of so-called supermarkets, which you can see in that picture. But the building on the left is, in fact, the local brothel. And I can tell you a little bit about my experiences of being dropped by the taxi outside that brothel on another occasion. So our research had a number of dimensions. We wanted to understand the sorts of problems that low-paid workers were experiencing, how the EU settlement scheme was working in practice, and most importantly, how do migrant workers sort their problems out when things go wrong? And that's the strand of the work I would like to talk to you about this evening, the experiences of migrants at work. And the story, as you may guess, is not a happy one. And this raises questions about the enforcement of rights. Now, clearly, in the UK, there are mechanisms to enforce rights, primarily to go to employment tribunals. And one of the questions I want to think about is, do they actually go to employment tribunals and enforce their rights? And if not, what do they do instead? So I want to just briefly tell you about some of their experiences at work. Now, as you've seen, they've been working in poultry factories primarily. And what they tell us so much is about the cold and how the cold affects their hands. They all talk about the terrible pains in their hands, how their hands really suffer in the environment. They also complain about the lack of training. They're expected to learn online, and very fast speed is an essential skill on the fast-paced factory line. Many of the participants in our research say that the first English word they ever learnt was faster due to the demands in the factory. And this is an example, it's a quote from one of our interviewees. They never showed me what to do. Literally, I went there and there was a massive group of people and like the supervisors coming and they go, you, line two. So that's it when I did that, because she pointed a finger at me and then, okay, so what the hell am I doing? So they put a basket of potatoes and scale and boxes and I'm like, okay, how much? 50 grams. Okay, so the first day I'm like 50, 47, faster. It's horrible. Nobody tells you what to do. And this is not by any means atypical. The other problem, and forgive the for mentioning it, but it comes up repeatedly, is that the factory staff were regularly refused toilet breaks. And this is a real issue for those working on the factory line, because they are all in PPE. You might remember the photo I showed you of them all in the PPE. And it takes some time to take the PPE off and put it back on, which is why they're denied toilet breaks. And this is a repeated issue that keeps coming up in any of the focus groups we can do. And you can imagine, if you can't go to the loo, what an effect it will have on your health. Now, all of the interviewees we saw agreed that the worst section in the factories involved lifting heavy weights. Interviewees said that they were expected to lift between 30 and 60 kilos. And these are very heavy, cold turkeys and heavy bones from one area to another. And in one focus group we did, there were six attendees and three were off work with health issues due to the physicality of the work on the factory floor. The other thing that was complained about a lot was the treatment by the so-called white helmets, which are managers. One interviewee complained that a Portuguese national was promoted to a managerial role and she caused problems to the Portuguese. She causes lots of problems, discrimination. She's very strict and demeans you. They yell at you. They're calling you names. They're talking with you very bossily. They humiliate you through their attitude. And I think this is the worst humiliation ever. And these problems are compounded by very long shifts, which is tiring, especially with travel time to the factory. So this is a street in Great Yarmouth. And as you can see, this is the bus that comes and picks them up. They're all queued to get on the bus, and the bus takes them out to the factories in the countryside. It's about an hour, hour and a half to get out to the factory. And you add 3 hours travel time to a daily shift. And the repeated message is the exhaustion. One Lithuanian interviewee says it's impossible if you work 12 and a half hours plus travel. If you've got children at home and a family to look after, cook for, your brain just goes all just exhausted. And we keep hearing stories of just how terrible the exhaustion is. They also say they lose any control. You have no say. That's how you feel. You have no say. Okay, mentally, it's very, very difficult. Now, what's interesting is that these issues are the issues that came out of the focus groups where people felt more able to express what was going on. But what did they go to Gyros for help with? Did they go to Gyros for help about these fundamental employment problems? What's it striking? This may be a bit difficult for you to see. But what they actually went to Gyros for was actually very technical things. In particular, they went to Gyros for things like not getting pay slips, not getting holiday pay. And it's interesting, you think, well, that's interesting. Why is it that what they're complaining about when they're asked directly about their experiences is one thing, but what they actually seek help for is something quite important, but still not of the fundamental nature that I've just been describing. Now, so they go to Gyros for paperwork issues. And of course, if they don't have their paperwork, that has knock-on consequences for claiming benefits, for getting EU settled status. They also go to Gyros a lot for getting help with translation or for interacting with managers or trying to understand their employment rights. Now, what we notice too is that workers in 0 hours contracts, those are the contracts where you're not guaranteed any particular amount of work, are particularly vulnerable. A number of Xerox contract workers have come to Gyros in respect of their hours of work being reduced. And this is a real problem. So give you a couple of examples here. This is someone not getting their paperwork for in order to get their holiday pay. This is an example of someone on a 0 hours contract. And on their 0 hours contract, what seems to be going on is that if you wanted to get extra hours or more hours or even just some hours in order to get your pay, you end up having to bribe the line manager in order to be given the hours to work. And this is not a one-off experience. I'll show you this again in a moment. But you see, you know, if the manager says we want X and X person, I'm 100% sure they're giving the money. You know, they give me £20 and I will make sure you're working 5 days. So the opportunity of earning £200, then of course you pay £20. So you've got a tax on actually having to get work in order to be paid for doing that work. The other thing that we see, and this is not rocket science, but is well known by to others who record it too, is problem clustering. And by problem clustering, it's a particular issue for those on 0 hours contracts, is that if you don't get work, you don't get paid, you can't pay your bills, so it means you risk losing your house. And then you're also in trouble because you probably haven't paid your council tax either, and you're being pursued for that too. And so you can see these clustered problems, which is problems around employment, which affects your housing. If you haven't got housing, it becomes very difficult to sort out your welfare benefits. You're in debt, and you can see how things spiral out of control very quickly indeed. So the story I've told so far is, it must be said, pretty grim. But some of you might be thinking, well, hang on a sec, you know, what about employment rights in this country? Surely they can access all of these employment rights that you hear about. Well, formally, the answer is yes. And indeed, under EU law, and these rules still apply to EU migrant workers who've got settled status, under EU law, EU migrant workers must not be treated differently in respect of access to conditions, employment, work, remuneration, dismissal, as compared to British workers. So it looks like the simple answer is yes, of course they get access to all of these rights. There is, of course, a particular problem, which is that these factories are populated entirely by EU migrant workers, so it's very difficult to see a direct comparator who's being treated better. But the real problem is not so much do the rights exist, to which the answer is yes, there are all sorts of rights that exist, but the real problem lies in the question of enforcement. Now, again, EU law has got a formal answer to that. The formal answer is absolutely all the enforcement obligations that you find under domestic law should apply equally to EU migrant workers. But again, that looks fine until you start to think, well, what does enforcement mean? Well, enforcement means in the UK primarily going to courts. It means, in the case of employment law, going to an employment tribunal. And then for those of you who are interested, you can go up through the system to the Employment Appeal Tribunal and then into the general court system. But the first and foremost place to go to get your employment rights enforced is to an employment tribunal. And the UK government can quite rightly say, look, we are fulfilling our obligations under Article 3. Look, they can go to an employment tribunal like any British person. But our early research shows that EU migrant workers rarely take their cases to employment tribunals. And you can see this in the data. Now, there's a lot wrong with this data. I can talk at length about the problems, but I fully accept this data is weak, because when we did the first time we looked at the data, we had to go through several 100,000 cases by hand, trying to work out whether the cases involved EU nationals, and the indicators we used were not terribly robust, but they were better than not looking at all. And what you see in the first period when we did this research, that we could only find about 238 cases in that period being brought by EU nationals, which counted for 0.071% of the caseload going before the employment tribunals. Now, as we now know, there are somewhere in the region of about 5 million EU nationals in the UK, which tends to suggest a dramatic under-enforcement before employment tribunals. We did the same exercise for 2019 to 2022. By this time, all of the employment tribunal decisions have been put online, so it was easier to do the search. But again, our methodology is not robust. And actually, we found a few more cases, and the percentage had gone up somewhat, but still, we're looking at incredibly low levels of enforcement. Even now, for those who've been here for much longer, we're not surprised to see it's predominantly Polish people who are claiming. They were, up until recently, the largest migrant group. It's now just been overtaken by the Romanians, but they have been here for the longest. So you would expect to see more Polish bringing claims before tribunals. Now, those cases that did go to the tribunals, what is quite striking is, even though there were very few of them, they very much reflected what we had been seeing on the ground in Great Yarmouth. The stories that were being told in these cases were actually very similar. Look, issues about refusal of toilet breaks, being shouted at, bribery for better shifts. There were also issues that we were also seeing coming through in our own data of workplaces being dominated by nationality. So you'd have a Polish production line, you'd have a Portuguese production line. You would see discrimination between EU migrant groups, and you would see employers shouting at the staff not to speak in Polish or Portuguese. They had to speak in England. Don't you know you're in England now? So at one level, it's what we're seeing is what we're seeing in Great Yarmouth. What you're seeing in the cases tends to suggest that the experiences in Great Yarmouth are not unique. They're not isolated. They're probably happening elsewhere. We also see problem clustering, as we described before. So people who were living, who were given accommodation, often in caravans, to do work on farms, being dismissed. And of course, if they were dismissed when they were working on the farm, they also lost their accommodation too. And that meant they got themselves into real trouble. Another really terrible example of problem clustering is this case of Baran there. It was an appalling case. He'd been a chef in an Italian restaurant. He was diagnosed with cancer. When he went back to the restaurant, which is where he lived, after he'd been treated for cancer, he discovered that all of his belongings had been packed up and thrown out of the house. He brought claims for disability discrimination, wrongful dismissal, failure to provide a written statement, failure to provide wage slips, failure to be given written reasons for dismissal and wages claims, and he won every single one. So what's interesting is when you get to a tribunal, and we've got data on this, you're actually treated very well. The problem is most people don't go anywhere near a tribunal. And the tribunal was really shocked at the way he'd been treated. So there is considerable empathy in the tribunal. But what about the problems of bringing cases to tribunals? If it's correct that you get treated well once you're there, what are the problems of bringing claims? Lots and lots of problems about procedure. Poles in particular bring with them their own legal system. So they say, well, in Poland, you've got 6 years to bring a claim. In the UK, you've got 3 months to bring a claim before an employment tribunal. So you need to get your skates on. And in the case of this particular individual, he'd actually gone and got legal advice, but the excellent solicitor failed to respond to most of his emails, subsequently took his money and then didn't respond to his emails, and he was out of time. In fact, he eventually did get before the tribunal, and he was treated with considerable empathy, and he was allowed to bring a claim out of time because he had been treated so badly by the solicitor and his English was so poor. Now, of course, it's not just these technical barriers, but it's also other barriers to enforcement in front of tribunals. So, as I've said, period of residence. So the longer you're here, the more likely it is you will bring a claim, probably because your English is better, probably because you're more confident about the system. But we've also seen other barriers to enforcement. What I've put there rather euphemistically is cultural expectations. There is a real fear on the part of particularly those from Central and Eastern Europe about engaging with the state in any way. And they actually feel that there is a real risk to their security of their residence in the UK if they bring an employment tribunal claim. They also bring with them their own experiences of work, that what's the point? Does it really make any difference? And then, of course, there are a myriad of practical and legal obstacles about bringing a claim. So they fear reprisals from their employers. If they bring a claim, they think, although this is not proved out by the data, that there's a low chance of success. They don't know really how you actually approach an employment tribunal. So all of this emphasis on individual enforcement shows that enforcement doesn't happen. And that problem is exacerbated by the absence of trade unions in many workplaces, certainly in the ones we are dealing with, and the absence of a system of labour inspectors. And this leaves EU migrant workers, indeed all migrant workers, extremely exposed. So what I've said to you so far is that there is really a very low level of enforcement. those bringing cases faced formidable hurdles. But when there is enforcement, you do see what it very much reflects what we've seen on the ground in Great Yarmouth. But because there is such low levels of enforcement, what we're seeing is that employers are getting away with some really quite appalling conduct at work. And worse still, it goes on and on and on. There is no evidence that things are getting better for EU migrant workers. And that's why our longitudinal data is interesting, because the same issues come back time and time again, which of course means that these migrant workers are being treated very badly. Bad employers are getting away with it. And good employers, of course, are paying the price because they're not competing on poor quality. Now, that brings me back to Gyros and frontline organisations. Are frontline organisations telling migrant workers to go to tribunals? Well, the answer, at least in the case of Gyros, is basically no. They are not telling people to bring cases to the tribunals. What we've seen from the Gyros data is that there are best part of 7,000 case notes. And we can't find in those 7,000 case notes, so these are case notes on all of the clients that we've seen, that have been seen by Gyros, there is no express reference to employment tribunals. And there are two references to ACAS, which is the stage before you get to an employment tribunal. And indeed, one Gyros advisor said, in all my years at Gyros, I have only had three people who've made complaints to tribunals, but a lot more have made complaints to me, people don't follow it through. So this raises the question, what do they do? Do they lump it? Or do they actually just look to find another job where things may or may not be better? And for many, that is the answer. The main response is simply to move on. Now, we want to dig a bit deeper to find out really what is going on to the clients. Do they just move on or do they get other forms of help? Now, we can't generalise from the rest of the country, but we can talk about Great Yarmouth. And we know that what happens to EU migrant workers who are struggling is that they go to a Gyros drop-in. They go to the old Debenham store to get advice. And crucially for the those in Great Yarmouth, they get advice in their mother tongue. And we know that the help they get from the Gyros advisors is tremendously practical. So what happens, what you see, is that the Gyros advisor doesn't send people off to employment tribunals, instead says gets on the phone to an employer to find out why they haven't been given their P45 or their P60. And they will get on the phone to the local benefits agency to try and find out what's going on. They will get on the phone to the recruitment agency to find out why the client hasn't been given his holiday pay. Now, what I'm trying to get you to see is what we're seeing is very pragmatic solutions. Another case of Gyros helping a client into a new job by helping him write a CV, fill out the application form, and even phone the new company on his behalf. And then they also help the client to apply for Universal Credit. And what's striking about this, and this is one of the things that is distinctive about frontline advice agency work, is how holistic it is. It's not like going to see a solicitor, which will only deal with one particular issue, your employment issue or your housing issue. What you have with the frontline advisory organisations is that they try and tackle a whole range of issues all at once. And so from the client's point of view, this is actually very valuable indeed. So what we're seeing with these frontline advice organisations, or certainly Gyros, is that they don't take a sort of employment rights legal, law-driven approach. Instead, they focus on the problems that the individuals are experiencing. They focus on sorting out those problems. And that the Jaros advice approach is not just dealing with one specific problem, but they also act as advocate, they act as donor, they give money to the clients if they need money for a train fare to go for a job interview. They're advisor, translator, they sort out appointments with GPs, really important as a way of indicating that the individual is settled in the United Kingdom. And so what they offer is a one-stop shop for resolving problems, and it's very different to the approach taken by traditional legal advisors. And of course, they're also trusted. They're trusted in a way that lawyers, solicitors might not be, because they speak the language. And crucially, in the case of Jaros, a number of the advisors have made the same migration journey as those people they're advising. So they know what it was like working in a chicken factory. They know how factory lines, production lines actually work. And the clients really appreciate it. The clients think this is fantastic. The clients say, if you look at their feedback, I mean, the feedback is off the scale. For those of you who are students in the room, you know, we're all subject to questionnaires. We got questionnaire returns like this. You know, we would be absolutely in the clover, just to point a note to you at the back. But the fact is, the clients love it. And so what we are trying to develop and what we're thinking about is what we call pragmatic law, because this is what is going on at the front line, which is not what actually we teach in law schools. Because what we're seeing here is, of course, it's law, but neither advisors nor those being advised think of it as law. And what we're also seeing is a very high level of pragmatism. So you think this is actually a pretty good thing. So isn't this a marvellous way forward? It's cheap, it's effective, and the clients really appreciate it. So you might say, should we tell students to stop learning law and just, you know, all work on the front line and to help sort out people's problems? But we're also conscious that there are really significant disadvantages with this frontline advisory work. It misses key legal points. And what you see, as it goes back to the slides I was showing right at the beginning, they will sort out someone not getting their P45. They will sort out the fact that they haven't been given £400 for holiday pay. But what they are not addressing as the more fundamental issues, that what's going on in the workplace is some pretty terrible harassment, bullying, discrimination. And these do not come up. If you remember that slide I showed at the beginning about what sort of things come to Jaros's attention, it's the very pragmatic things about not getting payslips. It's not about the bullying, harassment, the not getting the toilet breaks and the implications of that for an individual's health and safety. And crucially, nothing changes. There is nothing, because there's no bringing together of all of this data. And that's the next stage of our project, is to be looking at what the data we've got from Jaros and actually developing a tool which we're going to use with a number of frontline advice organisations across East Anglia to help them actually collect the data they've got, systematise it, analyse it, and then try and do something with it. And the interesting question is, what do they do about it? For EU migrant workers, what they can do about it is to go to the IMA, the Independent Monitoring Authority, which was set up under the withdrawal agreement. And the IMA is really keen for data on the ground. So the IMA exists only until probably 2028. It's essentially the European Commission in the UK keeping an eye on how EU migrant workers are being treated. And they are based in Wales, so about as far away from Great Yarmouth as possible. But they are in regular contact to find out what is actually going on, because they are taking things up with the UK government. And as you may know, the IMA has just brought judicial review proceedings against the UK government about settled status and the switch from pre-settled status to settled status. Bottom line is, I hope you found what we've been talking about interesting. I hope you see that this is very un-Cambridge law. because Cambridge Law is very black letter and focuses right at the top of the pyramid on Court of Appeal and Supreme Court and so forth. What we're looking at is right at the bottom, at street level. And what we're trying to do is to develop some tools to analyse what's going on, to help with the cohort that we're looking at, EU migrant workers, but ultimately it may eventually be of some benefit for also domestic low-paid workers who experience a lot of the problems that EU migrant workers do. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.